We gotta spread this stuff around. Let's put it on the internet.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Great heavens! What kind of radio show is this?
Now, you said earlier that there were instances where you almost died or whatever. You thought your life was in danger. Can you tell me one of these stories? Because I know you're a masterful storyteller. I never even know about this crazy journey that you went on as a kid. I'm like, I'm amazed. I'm just blown away by this because to me it's like I can kind of imagine how you did it and everything, but at the same time it's like it seems completely like unfathomable. You know,
it is unfathomable now.
And, yeah. You just flew to India and just be like, all right, now I want to go to Marrakesh. So how do I get there? Just kind of throwing it out.
When I got out of art school, I knew I was not ready to take my place in the New York art world. I had gotten my deferment from fighting in Vietnam, which is something that I had been committed to for years.
Bone spurs.
You know, people called us, people called us draft dodgers, but for me, it was always very political. I knew it was a wrong war. I opposed it, and with my parents' backing, although it was heartbreaking when we got close to it, they were ready to say goodbye and watch me head for Sweden or Canada. But I cleared it, and what did I do? I got a job on a Norwegian freighter as a common seaman and shipped out. And I then just started to drift east with no plan. After months, I did everything overland. I literally went from New Haven Harbor to the Tibetan border. It took almost half a year, completely overland. And that included kicking in with a couple of guys in Istanbul and buying a beat-up Volkswagen camper, fixing it up, driving several thousand miles across the Great Salt Desert in Iran and into Afghanistan, and then taking off on my own again. But there came a time when I was in Nepal, a country I love very much, and felt very comfortable, even though it was one of the most foreign places I had ever visited. And after some weeks, I had my sea legs. I had climbed a small mountain with some friends, gotten bored of visiting the local hashish stores. And, the reality was much more exciting than, getting wasted. And I decided I was going to take a trek to the Tibetan border. I knew that Nepal described and aptly might still describe its position in the world as a little clay pot between two huge iron kettles, in this case, India and China.
Right.
And they had to be very careful with those two neighbors or they could get possibly swallowed up like Tibet was. And I knew that I had to stop. I think it was 3 miles from that border. And it was a good, was it a 15-mile? I couldn't find anybody to go with me. And I decided to do it on my own. At the time, and I still have all my paperwork, I had a special trekking permit, which stipulated that I understood that I would be on my own and I would have to be responsible for myself 100%, bring all my own food, medication if I thought I was going to get sick. I signed off on it and headed down the road. Some days into that trek, I got sick. It wasn't like it was dead of winter or anything. In fact, it would have been May or June of that year, and I developed a fever. I remember finding a place by the side of this completely, raw, untraveled trek through, looking at the Himalayas and things, and shivering in that sleeping bag, sweating through it, too exhausted, take some of my dehydrated food and, mix it with water in my canteen and heat it up and thinking, I'm going to die here. I'm going to die here. And how am I about that? I'm so upset for my parents and my sisters and my grandmothers and my cousins and people that love me. And is anybody going to find me here? Should I, use all my strength and get closer to the road? I wasn't even panicking. It was beyond that. It was just
like a resignation.
Well, I guess that would be a word that I guess I thought I was going to live longer. Gee, I guess people will remember me because I certainly didn't die in a conventional way.
Yeah.
But that is a little solace right now. I wish I hadn't done this.
Regret.
Yeah, and then a certain amount of time passed. I don't remember it, but I woke up a morning or two later, and whatever had been going on with me had passed. I felt weak as a little whatever, but I was rejuvenated. I made myself a meal. I did some reading. I walked slower, and I made it to those first signs that say warning. This area is coming in toward the Tibetan border, and by virtue of the Chinese government, the People's, Republic of China, and headed back with a story that, people ask, I'll tell. In the Khyber Pass, which separates Afghanistan from Pakistan, it's one of the rawest, most wild, most desolate areas I've certainly ever seen.
Yeah.
It's all rock, and since the time of Alexander, it's been fought over. And even in modern times, it's so... You remember all the talk when we first went into Afghanistan in 02 or 03 about Tora Bora, and, army wouldn't even go in there. I was roaming all over there by myself, and I wanted to get to Pakistan because it was the only way to get to India, and I got my bus ticket, and about halfway through the Khyber Pass, I'm absentmindedly looking forward, and I see that there are people in the road, and they are getting more detailed, and they are guys with firearms and bandoleras of shotgun shells and, scruffy beards, and they stop the bus, and one of them gets on. The other ones are standing around very casually, not even brandishing weapons, but, big pistols tucked into their waistbands and things, smoking cigarettes. And one of them just walks down the aisle, and it looked to me like he was just nodding at us all. What he was doing was counting the people on the bus. Because the bandits who hold the Khyber Pass, or held it at the time, with complete okay of the government of Pakistan and Afghanistan, was simply doing what they always do and exacting tribute from anybody that went through there.
Yeah.
And, if the bus fare was 10 Afghanis, one Afghani went in tribute to the bandits. And I remember just being completely gobsmacked that we were all being robbed by bandits in the friggin' Khyber Pass. Well, almost half a year later, I'm heading back west, ultimately to Afghanistan to hit the Soviet embassy and talk my way into a visa to get into the Soviet Union at the height of the Cold War as an American Jew. And we're held up again, and I recognize some of the same guys. I almost wanted to wave.
Did they recognize you?
Oh, no, I don't think so. They were busy, business-like, just collecting the tribute, moving forward. Now, that wasn't a life-threatening experience, but, when you're on your own, completely in the middle of nowhere, and this, of course, was at a time when to contact somebody telephonically in the United States was a transatlantic call, very expensive. I called my family 3 times in 1 year. I called them when I got to Scandinavia. I called them when I found kind of a surrogate family in Denmark who were wonderful and took me in for about a month. And then I called them almost a year later when I was back in Europe and getting myself ready to head back. I should also say that, it sounds like, how did this guy do this? I had about $2,000 in the bank. This is the early 70s. The dollar was king. I have always been able to manage a good budget. And I spent, I think, less than $2,000 in 1 year. But you have to understand that for more than half of that year, I was traveling in Asia where living on a dollar a day was almost exorbitant.
What seems amazing to me is the logistics of that in that time. How do you carry all that money with you?
That's a great question. I because
you couldn't use an ATM or anything like.
No, I had left the States thinking, if I can push this, you know, maybe 2 months or so, maybe 3 months, that would be awesome. And, you know, the first period of that year, a lot of it was spent, you know, with middle-class concerns of, what the fuck am I doing? I should be working. I should be, you know, developing, you know, my reputation as an artist. I should be visiting my grandmother. I should be around for my parents and for my sisters. And then at a certain point, it's like, wait a minute. I'm on a journey here, and I'll be back when I'm back. I left the States with several $100s in traveler's checks, I think $200 in cash, separate from 100 brand-new single American dollar bills, which once I got to Asia, you'd be amazed what some of those dollar bills opened the world to. And then, you know, I had like a savings bond and some stocks that a great aunt had given me when I was bar mitzvahed. And, you know, 6 months into the trip, 8 months into the trip, I would write home and request that my parents, you know, send traveler's checks or what have you, or a bank transfer. It was always to post-restaurant, which was the term for the post office in the major city that you were heading toward. And
okay.
Things would miss me sometimes, and I learned after the fact, much to my horror, and what I must have put my parents through, bless their hearts, that some of my mail was lost, and there were times where they didn't hear from me for months. In fact, there will be a book on this.
This is fascinating.
Work, and it is a hell of a story, and one that I'm looking forward to telling in detail. But my dad saved every letter, every postcard.
Oh, nice. Yeah. See, because that's the other thing I was thinking of as you're telling me the story. It's like nowadays, if you were that age now, it's like you would feel compelled to document all this shit on, you know,
Facebook,
we'd follow you the whole way through.
I would be
twittering
away along with our president. No. In fact, I kept notebooks. I kept literally every piece of, you know, bureaucratic minutiae, every map that I had. I also took several hundred photos. That sounds like so few in a year, but this was camera film, some of which was priceless. And at one point, I sent some back to the States. It was there when I got back a year later, and then I had it developed. I sent other film back to the States, including images I captured in Afghanistan in the pre-war days and Iran under the Shah, that vaporized. They're gone. But I have those photographs, but the letters. For years, my dad would say, you want to see those letters you sent? Nah, that's the past. I could care less. And maybe 10 years ago or so, I said, I'll take a look. And that very first sentence of that first aerogram shot me right back onto that freighter. I ended up transcribing everything, you know, 50 pages, single spaced or so. So I've got, you know, the modus to tell the story in terms of documentation. But none of this was planned. I had no idea where I was going or to some degree even why. I now understand myself better at that time and understood that I was looking for essentially myself. And to have put myself in situations where I know I could be self-reliant, I would say that the most important things in my life that have assisted me in becoming the person I became and somebody who I like myself. I've worked on being me for a long time, was going into therapy for about almost 7 years with the former first assistant of Dr. Wilhelm Reich. The fact that I was lucky enough to have an absolutely sensational family. You know, we're all neurotics, but a lot of love and a lot of support, wonderful sisters, great parents, cousins, wonderful friends, and taking this dare that I dared myself, that, you know, if my then soon-to-be ex-girlfriend had just said, I've changed my mind, let's stay together, I would have canceled that trip. And,
who knows? Yeah, that's a real, yeah. That's a,
Until the night before, I turned in my passport to the master of the MS Saab in the New Haven Harbor in Connecticut and was a member of the Norwegian Merchant Marine. I could have been talked out of it easily, but there's a perfect example. Take those dares in life, even if it's some little weekend trip to some place you've never been. I know that one of the reasons I've built this pathetically awful way to earn a living is that it has allowed me a lot of travel experiences, opportunities to meet people I would have never met otherwise, and UFOs, shmoofos, whatever the story is with them, whatever contributions people will look back on and say that I made to the work, for me, the biggest payoffs has been the friends I have made, the adventures I have had, the situations I've been put in to challenge myself, to grow from, the fights that I've been in, whether I've won or lost them. I realize sometimes with some sadness that there are people who, with all the reasons that are so easy to understand, would rather devote a good part of their life to building equity, security, all that stuff that part of me should have been doing. And then finding out that, gee, I'm fairly getting along now. What do I want to do with everything I have?
Yeah.
You know, I can take a cruise or something like that, or lots of them. I can travel in style and comfort. But there is something about being in the middle of nowhere, thousands of miles from home, with a pack on your back, relying entirely on yourself until you, you know, connect up with your next group of friends or a traveling pal for, a day or a week or whatever.
Yeah, yeah.
Of rolling with the punches and of using it all to appreciate how fortunate you are rather than, you know, comparing yourself to people in your same culture who are better off than you. Ufology,
amazing.
The study of this phenomena is very important to me. But as I said, it's not something I love. It's an obsession, and I resented for years. I still have some resentment, in fact, that it derailed my primary dream from early childhood because I was fortunate enough to know what I wanted to do when I was 5 years old, 6 years old. I was a very precocious young artist with a lot of encouragement from the grown-ups around me and grandparents and parents who would take me to the great museums in New York. Oil painting lessons when I was 8 years old. Little did I know that $10 a week really was a major chunk of my parents' weekly budget. I am just so thankful for so many opportunities that I've had, but it's also created a certain dynamic that I would encourage anybody to do anything they can to do, where you are so involved in living your life that those numbers clicking away that are associated with, as we say, how old you are, become more and more like an existential joke. My father on a bad day will say, you know, Pete, I'm getting old. And I think to myself, yes, compared to a layer of tertiary coal or a brontosaurus, you are getting old. But for many people who are almost 98, they would say they are old. And my sister and I and our friends kind of marvel at that attitude because it's real for him. He is, you know, it's all catching up with him, and who knows how long we'll have him. But he is still getting old. He is not old. And I'd like to be in that place when I wake up one morning and find out I died the night before. Life should be an adventure. And unfortunately, in part because the world has become a more dangerous place, that adventure has to be tailored a bit, rationalized. But I'm one of the luckiest people I know in that respect.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're one of the most content people I know. I can say that for sure. You know, you're not like, there's not a lot of anxiety swirling around you, if that makes any sense. A lot of people have this sort of anxiousness in this field, but you've always sort of struck me as this, like, calming influence.
Somebody made a post on Facebook a couple of months ago that I just roared, and it touches you at a certain point in your life, and you're getting there at some point. And it was, I hate it when I see an old person and then I realize I went to high school with them.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I resent it too.
Yeah, I've confronted many of those sort of weird scenarios. Yeah, where you see something on TV and they like talk about how old someone is, whether it's an athlete or something like that, and they're like 35 or something, and it's like,
mm-hmm.
What? Wait a minute.
Well, let's face it, some people are kind of born old.
Old souls, yeah.
Yeah, or you know, worried about things that you shouldn't be worrying about for decades, for goodness sakes. You should be, you know, living your life, enjoying it, being in love, fighting battles, you know, building something. And, you know, they're just, it's not a bad thing. And like the whole grasshopper and the ant, you know, one is playing around and the other one is building equity. I would never be the kind of person that would say, if I had it to do all over again, I'd do it the same. I think anybody that would say that is legally insane.
Yeah.
Or, in fact, that rare one in a million person who has had an ideal life. I would have started by, even though I never followed sports, well, not since I was 11 in an organized way, I remember, you know, flipping baseball cards in the 50s with my friends at elementary school, and gosh, I wish I would have saved them and my comic books. And then invested in gold when it was 125, and then bought into this new company called Microsoft in 1979, and I would have been richer than Bill Gates. But it doesn't work like that. You can play with those things in your mind, but if you ever let them get to you,
oh,
you're
God,
off.
Yeah. yeah, that's something. Yeah, that's another sort of life lesson I've learned over time. Yeah, yeah, you cannot obsess over decisions made. It's
nah.
Like there's really nothing you can do about it, you know?
No, really isn't.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You know, we talk about getting older, and like we were saying about our sort of like our departed friends and how it's, you know, who knows what we're going to see, in our lives. I hesitate to even bring it up, but it's like, look at, you know, when we first met in 2004, we were like, look at, you guys are going to be talking again like almost 15 years from now, and country's going to be on like, it's going to feel like the country's going to be on the precipice of a civil war.
Good Lord.
Because Donald Trump is the president.
Yeah.
Like, we would have believed the aliens would have landed before we would have believed that.
I, as a New Yorker, I agree in overdrive, and it's a reminder that no matter what we think, no matter what we believe, no matter what we're working toward, everything, whether it's on a very interpersonal level or internationally, can change on a dime in a second. So as we used to say in the 60s, be here now, certainly as much as possible. The past is gone. The future doesn't exist yet. The only thing that really exists is the moment in terms of our experience as human beings, other than our thought experience. So embrace it fully. I love reflecting back on certain parts of my past, absolutely wince at other parts. I look forward to all kinds of interesting things in the future and know that they will or won't happen. Classic example is my usual routine as a self-employed writer, photographer, artist, is toward the latter part of the year, and then in the first months of the new year, work hard to, you know, get your speaking jobs, line up articles that you can sell, different appearances, things that you can do to pay your bills. Ideally, doing things that mean something to you. But when you can't get that work, then doing it by working at other things. I have had friends who I know are so principled in a way and so dedicated to the work that if they didn't have the work, they just stopped and money wasn't coming in. For me, you know, being a graduate of the finest art school in the country, even though I'm not a practicing artist now, although I look forward to moving back into that over the next few years and moving forward with, I've been a passionate photographer for over 40 years, but I've never exhibited my work. I do it for my own satisfaction, for my friends, but I've got some remarkable images from more than 30 countries and, you know, coming in toward, you know, more than 40 years. And I would hate to think that I would turn a corner and, you know, find that, oh, gosh, I guess I'm not going to do any of that stuff, and life is just going to be kind of boring right now. And, you know, I could never see myself, for example, even if I had the means to not have to work again. The idea of retiring, I think it's wonderful for some people. For me, I have so many things that interest me. Mm. Why would I ever want to stop looking into them or taking part of them? I look at, you know, friends and colleagues. A perfect example is Stanton Friedman.
Right.
Stan's, I guess, 82 or 83 now. He is still kicking major ufological butt. He is an extraordinary lecturer. He loves what he does. He's one of a handful of people in the history of the field who has made a living at it.
Mm-hmm.
I knew Zachariah Sitchin to some degree, and he was working right up until he died at 90. Bud certainly had to stop before he was 80 when he died because the cancer made it very difficult for him. But he worked as long as he could, like good character actors. You do this because, yes, if you're lucky, it pays your bills, but because you love doing it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. It's amazing. Yeah, I've always had a real affinity in my heart for sort of the folks that have been in this for such a long time, you know, the legends, if you will.
Yeah, and, you know, another one was, again, our friend Jim Mars.
Yeah.
Met Jim many years before I met him. A lot of people in ufology or the conspiracy communities don't even realize what an unbelievably courageous newspaper reporter this man was. I'm old enough to remember the Kennedy assassination, and it broke my heart. You know, I was a little kid who hero worshipped this, you know, young, vital guy who, like my dad, had fought in World War II and had a beautiful wife and this lively family. And when he went, a lot of, you know, it was just like losing a member. And the information that was coming to us over the next years about the assassination was so mixed. And it was Jim who began to break it open on a whole other level with a book that every one of your listeners should read called Crossfire.
Oh, yeah.
I've got a good, not a huge, but a good library of material on the assassination and related events. And that book absolutely knocked me flat. And it wasn't until years later when I was in Denver at the one of my favorite bookstores in the country, the Tattered Cover, and in, you know, going over the spines in the UFO books and just, whoa, wait a minute, Jim Mars wrote a UFO book? Bang, pulled that out, Alien Agenda, of course, being a very self-involved person, immediately went to the index to see if I was in it.
That's the, yes, if you know you've been in ufology for a while, if that's this, I've done it myself, so yeah.
And I was, and it was a very flattering remark, and some years later, we had the opportunity to meet in a great way some very well-heeled New Yorker who was into the subjects that Jim wrote about, brought him to New York. I don't remember how I got invited, but I remember being in a very, very fancy Fifth Avenue apartment looking out on Central Park from a high floor with maybe 15 people at a cocktail party. And Jim, immediately we connected, being the same height and wearing similar hats, and never being shy of tearing somebody's ears off by trading stories into the dawn. Had a lot of fun with him over the years, and again, miss him terribly, but there's a guy who lived his life.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I would hope that he had no regrets by the time he moved on. He was an inspiration to a lot of us, and in our culture now, I am concerned increasingly with not just younger people, but my concern is more for them, because, you know, I live in rural central New York State, surrounded by working farms with deer and foxes and other wonderful creatures around the house. But I'm a city kid, and it still kind of blows my mind. I'm half a dozen miles from one of the greatest college towns in America, Ithaca, New York,
mm-hmm.
back in my hometown of New York City, usually once a month unless I'm on the road. And that archetype of sitting on a subway and looking across at 10 people, and 8 of them are staring at these little handheld devices.
Oh, yeah.
One's asleep and one's reading a newspaper. That some people are literally losing the ability to carry on a one-to-one, face-to-face conversation and forget about debating a subject. The idea, cursive writing is disappearing.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. It's crazy, yeah.
It's very upsetting. And the idea that for bibliophiles like me, who, you know, the Holy of Holies is holding like a manuscript, you know, or a book that was signed or notated by a famous person, an actual physical book, that a manuscript is just a bit of digital information, that books per se, I love the idea of electronic books. I still don't have one. My brother-in-law, I remember when he got his Kindle, and I said, how many books are, you know, on that? He said,
all of them.
Great, Tim, very good. 1,100. And I thought, this is amazing. You know,
yeah.
Maybe it is all back-engineered alien technology, this whole digital thing. Another wonderful subject I used to go back and forth with Bud Hopkins, who felt very strongly that, yes, when we first started to hear that term, back engineering, captured a lot of our imaginations. I think it kicked in with the when Bob Lazar became a public person, that particular phrase. But we both agreed, we human beings at our best, when things are optimum and we're working together, as my old boss used to say, anything the mind of man can conceive, it can achieve. Mankind, that is, as opposed to men. And who knows, maybe fiber optics and the internet and, you know, your iPhone 6 is all a product of back engineering, or we did it on our own, damn it, and we don't need no, you know, aliens to do it. It's an unanswered question for anybody but the insiders that know because they cracked it, or they know it because it wasn't cracked. We can debate this, of course, you know, forever. And
yeah, yeah, it's interesting.
But these, you know, these devices that were beyond luxuries to us, you know, a moment ago in time, that are now ultimate necessities.
Right, right, yeah.
I think they're rewiring, you know, brains. And in a few generations, not only will, you know, people's thumbs have evolved in a slightly different way.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But we will be dealing with an epidemic of brain cancers from people holding these radioactive devices so close to their heads from the time that, in some cases, they're toddlers and their parents just to get off their back. Here, hold my phone. And
oh, God. Yeah,
I find that incredibly disturbing.
Yeah, it's interesting.
It sounds like an old fogey, but
yeah.
you know,
I'm in agreement with you. Yeah, no, it's the whole... Yeah, the whole sort of transformative nature of this thing. Again, going back to, like, you and I mean, we met back in 2004. It was like, there were cell phones then, but it wasn't like this. You know, people weren't. I don't think, I think if we could take, if we could, like, remote view ourselves back to that bar in the hotel that night,
That's
those two nights, and look around, I bet you, like, there wouldn't be a single person on a phone like they are now, because it wasn't like that back then.
I remember, we're going back now, probably 20 years or so, when I did my first major trek around England after visiting repeatedly working on the Rendlesham case, that going into a bar with a number of British friends and acquaintances who would then take out their phones and put them on the table, I thought, oh, this is so hokey. Larry Warren and I, who I wrote Left at East Gate with, we had been given a loaner phone by our publisher. And my first thought when he gave us the phone when we were about to commence on a month-long 15-city speaking tour was, what the hell am I going to do with this? This is just you know, a bourgeois joke. And, of course, within 24 hours, we couldn't live without it.
Right, right, yeah.
But at that time, it was just, gee.
It was just a phone, though.
Yeah, exactly.
I lived in England in the year 2000, and it was like, that was, yeah, I was taken aback by that, too, because they adopted the mobile, as they say over there. They had it like that. It was kind of like how it became here, where it was like everybody had a mobile. You had to have a mobile phone. And it was like
I thought I'm living in the future, and at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, that's how I felt when I got back to America, because I went out and got one, and I'm like, oh, you don't have a mobile? What are you?
I'm never going to need one of these, of course, you know, but I get that. I understand why some people really like them. Yeah, right. As I look at my little flip phone from 1942.
Yeah, it's just remarkable. It does make you wonder, like, in a way, it's like, you know, we're talking about, like, is it reverse engineered technology or the product demand? It's like, sometimes I wonder, in a way, it's like, if it's some kind of virus, like, technological virus, in a way, where it's like, once we you know, like a technological alchemical sort of, like, virus, in a sense, where it's like, we stumbled upon, we unleashed something that we really shouldn't have.
In a funny way, you know, especially for my dear friends whose major preoccupation in life at this moment is their Second Amendment rights, and I've certainly enjoyed shooting firearms. I've been a gun owner. I keep a rifle in the house, but it's always been, you know, the zen of hitting the mark since I shot my first rifle when I was in the Boy Scouts. And you know, taking responsibility for knowing how to use another power tool or something. But it is a little like a virus in that George Orwell or the great visionaries of how things might turn out if they weren't going well, forget about having, you know, your guns taken away. We've already lost the war in a way. We, the great majority of people in this country, can't live without their cell phones. And they would trade almost anything for, you know, I have to have access to the Internet. I have to have my cell phone. I need this new technological doohickey here. I've got some cool clothes. I've got a job that I sort of like. I can go out, you know, and have a drink or a nice restaurant meal when I want to. And I live in a nice part of town. I've got it all going for me. Whatever's going on in the world is going on in the world. I can't affect it, but I look pretty cool. You know, maybe I'll get laid tonight. I just traded my new phone in. Life's good. Sadly and frighteningly, it's happened already. We've been co-opted.
Yeah.
And for some people, I think it's too late to wake up. For other people, you don't have to go into a paranoid frenzy to understand that this is part of the way the world is, but it doesn't have to include you.
Yeah, exactly. You know, as with all things, it's like there needs to be some moderation with this stuff. You know, it's the young – it's like, get off my lawns. It's the young people. It's the young people I worry about, Peter. It's the young people.
You young people today.
But, yeah, you know, it makes you wonder, like, whether because I read an article the other day. I read the headline. I didn't read the article. I read the headline that said, you know, AI has replaced aliens as the – and this was, like, from a mainstream outlet, like a new, you know, Newsweek or Wired or something, where it was like AI has replaced aliens as, like, the looming invasion threat in some people's minds. And it's, like, it's kind of true in a sense where it's, like
– It is.
This whole – our whole civilization has been, like, enveloped by technology.
Well, and it's now it's been around for a while, but it's now going into another hyperstate that concerns me, which is, you know, people used to make jokes about these absolutely pathetic-looking rubber blow-up, you know, sex dolls.
Oh,
and now, you know, you've only to, you know... be on Facebook to see that we're approaching a time, if we're not there already, probably we are in Japan and a number of other first world countries, where there is an availability of these, you know, sexually available robots of both sexes.
Yeah.
And for me, it is one of the most heartbreaking commentaries and thoughts of our time that, oh, gosh, I don't want to date. You know, I'll get rejected. I think, you know, certain words define themselves. To screw somebody, that's very romantic.
Yeah.
Hook up. You know, is sex without obligations, fine, great. I was horny as hell when I was in my 20s, and, you know, it was the 60s, so I was doubly lucky. But at the same time, there are people who now will ultimately, as we move forward in time, not be that interested in pursuing an actual, you know, core relationship that is built on passion and mutual attraction and mutual interest and love and working through differences. It's just so much to do. It takes so much work.
Yeah, they'll just get a sex robot, and then they'll be
exactly,
like... Yeah.
Exactly.
There's only so much time in the day, man. I don't have time to go out.
I got my legal weed and my sex bot and my
yeah.
bag of Cheetos, and I'll see you next week. You know, that's... I'm only half joking.
I can totally see it, yeah.
On another level. And again... this is part of the world we live in, but it doesn't have to include you.
Right, exactly. Well, chances are, you know, for better or for worse, it probably won't, because the thing won't include you or I. Because
we can't afford the really high, you know, top-grade sex
yes,
anyway.
Exactly. Well, the glacial pace of all this, I was talking to Dr. Sally Cook-John back in January about this, in
yeah.
a sense where it's like, He's a scientist, like a legit scientist in Arizona, and I always give him shit because he's a, you know, he's a legit scientist, not from the paranormal world. And it's like,
yeah.
Tyler, you scientists are always promising us this shit and it never happens. I'm like, look, dude, if I drink too much and I get old and I need a new liver, I can't go down to the Home Depot of medicine and get a liver like they told me I was going to in the 80s.
It's not right. And where the hell... Our jetpacks.
Yeah, exactly.
I've been waiting for that since I was 9 years old, and I am pissed off.
Right. I said to him, like, all I ever heard back when I first got into this field, like 15 years ago, was how nanotechnology was going to transform everything, and stem cells were going to be like the future. It's like nothing's changed, man.
It ain't our future. It's the next future.
Right. It's like they're always promising us shit that's like 100 years ahead of our time. It's like, what good does that do me, dude?
But, you know, it's funny, at the same time, looking back on my childhood and remembering stories that, you know, my dad told me, like all dads, and my grandma told me, I was born before the Wright brothers flew and I lived to see men on the moon kind of thing.
That's true, yeah.
I think right now, yeah, I was born in the age of tube radios and, you know, a completely analog world. And for me... I fell in love with the world of film probably by the time I was about 8 years old, in part because there was a wonderful, real worship of a television program, certainly in New York at the time when I was growing up, called Million Dollar Movie. And what they did that was different than anything else was they chose a film, usually a great black and white classic, and they played it every single day during the week and like twice on Sundays. And so I had a chance not just to see great films, but to really, you know, memorize dialogue and falling in love with them, and thought, if I ever really make it, I'm going to have a special room in my house, a screening room. I'm going to have one of those big Bell & Howell 16-millimeter projectors, even better than the one that we have at Hewitt School, and I'm going to have metal racks with, you know, film canisters that I can thread through. And it never even dawned on me, it never even entered my imagination that a video cassette would come into existence and that real regular people could own a machine where you could put like a big tape thing in plastic in the machine and record something from your television. It's absolutely
yeah.
outrageous. And, of course, now you can do even more. But my dreams didn't even include that stuff then.
Yeah.
And now, of course, we have things that none of us would have dreamt of when we were kids, but we're still waiting for more practical things. You think of the tremendous amount of waste that our culture generates. I mean, it would break your heart. the amount of food that's wasted in this country. The fact that when I was growing up, every single town had shops where you brought almost anything to be repaired. I'm old enough to remember an old truck that used to roll through our little village down the street that I lived on every week or so, and it would ring a bell, and it was a guy who sharpened your scissors and sharpened knives. You didn't throw away something when it broke. You either learned how to fix it yourself or you brought it to a repair place. But over time, we have been, you know, sleepwalked into this age of disposability. And, you know, there are now areas all over the world that we might as well call, you know, zones of national sacrifice. There is a thing in the middle of the Pacific Ocean, bigger than several Texases, made up of
trash, you know,
plastic. This is a nightmare. This is insane. This is what happens when we're not good shepherds. And whether or not any of our friends believe or don't believe in climate change, or whether or not we contribute to it, and the fact that many people do not accept that human beings have contributed to it, to me, is infuriating and very saddening. But that, again, you don't have to even do anything good to make the world a better place. You just have to stop doing things that are hurtful, that are destructive, that are negative, like buying water bottles instead of getting, you know,
metal ones.
Yeah, and, you know, being responsible for not dumping, you know, 10,000 disposable bottles into our biosystem.
Yeah, those like Keurig cups.
Awesome.
They said they could stretch those Keurig cups like around the planet after like a month of all the people that use it.
Probably to the moon by this point.
Yeah.
It's maddening. And every time I see a post where somebody somewhere, and often like a high school kid in Africa or India or something, has thought up and created a simple device that you can build for a modest amount of money that will let you generate power to your yurt, or you know, to personally desalinate water. We are going to be fighting wars in this country within this world within a decade over water, and the fact that major multinational corporations, often that we associate with the most innocent things. For me, the word Nestle growing up meant hot chocolate. Coca-Cola, you know, that very popular sugar water around the world. These companies are emblematic of major, major multinationals that are buying up springs and natural water sources. Corporations are people, as we know, and the sooner that gets changed, the better, like taking money out of politics. Good luck with that one, although I think it's one of the few hopes of recovering what is left of our Democratic Republic that is in tatters at this point.
Yeah, I mean,
but not to give up. Again, live your own life by ethical rules, and get a kick out of contributing rather than, you know, taking the piss out of people, or you know, being a sarcastic bastard and just having nothing good to say or do. You're either a positive force in this planet or you're not. And in terms of the subject that brought us together and brings us together tonight, again, truly anomalous UFO phenomena and its implications for humanity. There is still a fight out there, and it's an important one to take part in, to do what you can to clarify the picture. Or I realize for myself, after hundreds of talks before large and small venues, hundreds of appearances, and I'll say that easily hundreds, over the past 40 years on radio and television and documentaries and things, that I one of the things I do best as a lecturer, as a writer, is kind of 101 stuff. I am rarely involved in cutting-edge debates on the nature of what creatures from Alpha Centauri look like, or who is truly behind, you know, the secret government. I couch a lot of my work in post-war history. I, as often as possible, draw upon the kind of evidence that you would want to see in a court of law, whether it's an authentically declassified document or results of a professional analysis of organic material that's come in contact with some phenomenological situation and has been changed or transformed or altered in the course of it. I kind of continue to feel that one of the things that I should continue to focus on is being that person who is just doing their best to get, not preaching to the choir, although most of my audiences are, you know, there because they're interested in the subject, and I continue to explore ways to broaden that, but to get them into the foyer and through that first door where they can come away from reading something that I've written or hearing something that a talk I've given and say, you know, that wasn't bad. I'm still equivocal about the subject, but I feel a little more secure now. Those documents were real, or you know, that physical analysis was real. And in the way that I was taught, I had three major mentors. Bud was the best known, a retired Hungarian Army staff officer named Komen Vodkovetsky, who was a in charge of photo reconnaissance for the Hungarian military during World War II. Extraordinary cop.
We can go past the thing, so don't worry about that.
Okay. Pete Mazzola, who died much too young, was a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who was also a crack UFO investigator, and along with Coleman and Bud, taught me to investigate this subject in as pragmatic and objective a way as possible. And please don't, for any of your listeners, don't misunderstand me. We're all feeling a different part of the elephant in this work.
Yeah.
And I think that there are many people who are onto important things that are more spiritual, that are more ethereal than I am. My specialty is nuts and bolts and triangulating around evidence. If you can find a documented account that supports evidence that we see in a photograph, that supports a physical analysis of material that is backed up by authentically declassified documents, build your case like a court attorney and present it as factually and as clearly as you can, as illustrated as you can, but, you know, a good talk and, you know, radio is a perfect medium. I'm a storyteller. It's just the stories I deal in. I don't, you know, they're true. And
yeah.
I hope to do that to some degree until I'm not here anymore.
Hey, man, yeah. I mean, I think you're going to be around for a while, I hope so.
You may be stuck with me for a while.
Just don't go try backpacking through Afghanistan again.
No. I'm glad I did it when I did, but yeah. No, I'd love to return on a certain level, but the Afghanistan that I want to return to only exists in my mind and mind
yeah.
of other people.
Yeah, yeah. It's too bad. Now, where can folks, you know, find out more from you and find out what you're doing next?
Well, I do have a Facebook.
You have a hub?
I have a long-neglected website, peterrobbinsny.com, that I keep meaning to update, but you can always visit me on Facebook. I keep removing friends so I can add new friends, having hit that embarrassing point of being what they laughingly call on Facebook a public person.
Oh, God, I just went through and called, like, 1,000 people off of my thing because it's like they
– whoa.
Well – I had like half a yours. I had like 2,000, maybe 2,500, and I cut it down to about 1,000 because it's like, I don't know if you know this, they pivoted off of news to like.
I know, I've noticed.
And they're like, now we just want to connect you to your friends, and it's like, that's
you know,
the with all due respect, folks, it's
me.
Like, yeah, they picked the worst time for it because it's like. Immediately then this shooting happened, and now I'm just inundated with, like, gun debates all day on there.
And both. And it's taking up all the oxygen in the room, and there is no quick resolve. I'm sorry to say I think our country is at a spot that it has not been since 1860. before the war between the states, or
right.
My friends down south say the war of northern aggression. I knew even as a kid that the term civil war was an oxymoron.
yeah.
But where can people connect with me next? If you're in New York State, I'm going to be not even giving a talk, but doing a reading, trying to stretch out the definition of ways to communicate on this subject for one of my favorite regional UFO groups. It's called the UFO Meetup Group in Rochester, New York, run by the amazing Cookie Stringfellow, resident ufologist being Rich Dolan. I'll be there on Wednesday the 14th. There may still be some space. The weekend after that, the I guess it's 16th, 17th, Friday and Saturday, I will be speaking and on panel discussions at the Whole Life Expo at the New Yorker Hotel in Manhattan. I will be at the Pinebush UFO Conference in New York State here in May. I'll be back in Roswell in July, I'm hoping. Looking good for Norway in August.
Wow, Norway.
Yeah, a new UFO conference coming at us in New York State in Syracuse in October.
Wow, Syracuse, that's my old stomping ground.
Yeah, yeah. We can use all of the UFO conferences we can get here.
Absolutely.
In the Northeast, and I'm very pleased to see a growing number of them, as we know, in New England.
Yeah.
But you'd think New York doesn't have a UFO conference. New York City doesn't have a UFO conference. Unfortunately, the main reason for that is people dedicated enough to put in the time, but venues are very expensive.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, it must be.
So I post all, you know, future talks and appearances on my Facebook page, and we'll try to get back into the professional habit of doing it on my website. But yeah, a couple of places you can see me and hang, and would love
nice.
To either reconnect with you or, you know, if you have questions you want to ask me in person, great. You can send me messages via Facebook if you're a regular listener to Tim and you want to get in touch with me, send him the message. He'll forward it to me, and I will get back to you. I try to get back to everybody that writes to me or contacts me. It's impossible, and I'm sorry to say I just can't do it.
Yeah, no, it's hard. I mean,
better than most.
Yeah, you're probably better than I am. I mean, I mentioned this to somebody the other day where it's like, folks, and everyone's there is different, I guess, in a sense, but it's like my best advice to anybody like sending an email or a message like that is like some people write like – six giant paragraph long message, and it's like
some of them really long for the answers and are absolutely sincere, which is
yeah. And the thing is like, I don't know how you feel, but it's like I always feel like I have to, you know, put the same amount of effort back into responding to them, and then next thing I know I look up and it's like a year 18 months ago.
The fact is I joke with my friends sometimes that I could have written as many books as Nick Redfern if I didn't respond to all the mail that I get.
Email
and Facebook related and in from other sources. I value human contact. I try to be a friend or acquaintance, but I do need to be a little more disciplined as I move forward as a writer, no question about it.
Absolutely. All right, man. Well, I want to thank you for everything. You know, like I said at the beginning of the show, I really wouldn't have gone on this journey, I think, if not for your friendliness at that event and, and your openness and just gregarious nature. I don't know what the words to use. It was just like, here I was some chump at a UFO event, and, like, you were one of the speakers, and you treated me just like someone whose opinion and thoughts were worth something. And it's like
– And they are.
Thank you, man. And that was kind of what gave me the inspiration where it was like, hey, my opinions have merit in this crazy field. So
well,
I really appreciate it.
And the fact is, I look at the body of work you've generated. Yeah, you know, you haven't been spending your time writing books at this point in your career, but you have hauled ass. What is it, 9 years, 10 years that you have been on the air? That's extraordinary. You have reached hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people over the years, and that I had something to do with triggering that, for me, is its own pay. Again, we joke about this stuff, but what's of value in this world? Making a positive difference is part of it. As
yeah,
well,
yeah, for sure.
Bills. So thank you as well. And I really enjoyed being back. And while I am sorry on a certain level that you are moving out of the realm of radio broadcasting, I know you will keep contributing. I look forward to seeing your writing, to continuing to build our friendship, and, you know, see you around the campus, I'm sure, a couple of times this coming year. But I've really enjoyed the past 2 hours, and holy moly, talk about missing time. We blew through that, didn't we?
I know. Yeah, for sure. Yeah. Well, you don't have to worry about me, man. You know, I've run through this all through my head, I guess, you know, especially lately because I'm sort of really getting close to the end. And it's like,
yeah.
You know, my hero was Bob Dylan, dude. And he was like folk, electric, you know, he was like a gypsy traveler in the early 70s. And then he was like in the gospel scene. And then he got in the 80s. And, you know, to me, it's like I have a thing on my message board where he said, you know, an artist is always in the state of becoming.
Yes.
And it's like I need to evolve and change and, you know, get into the next era of whatever I'm doing. And I'll still, you know, I can still pick up the phone and do a show whenever I want. You know what I'm saying? It's just like I'm never going
right.
to be – I don't want to be beholden to sort of the method by which we've been doing it for, like, the last decade. So.
It's so interesting on a closing note that of all of the creative artists of our time, you mentioned Bob Dylan, he – certainly was one of my heroes too, but in a completely different context. It began with that first folky song of his, to his protest songs, to that electrifying moment in popular culture history where he plugged that goddamn guitar in and blew all of our minds and then continued on. For me, he is the poet laureate of my generation, and my interest started to wane after he recovered from his motorcycle accident and got mellow. I wanted to, you know, go fast, die young, and leave a beautiful corpse, and now it's too late. Damn it.
Well, I can't thank you enough for everything, man. And I don't even know where to go with that. But I will, I'm sure.
Bless you. Woo! Bless you.
I must be allergic to good feelings. I can't thank you enough, and like I said, this is not the last time you and I will do an interview for a show, so don't even worry about that, but
okay.
It's sort of the last time within this realm and in this greater box set of this, what I've been doing. So thank you for everything over the years. Thank you for really being an inspiration when I first started out, and I'll see you around campus.
You bet, and do me a favor and post a link to this interview on my Facebook page so my friends can access it.
Absolutely, will do.
Thanks a lot,
Pat. Have a great night.
My best to your mom.
Absolutely, my best to your dad.
You got it.
Bye-bye.
Bye for now, Tim.
There you go, folks. That was Peter Robbins. That was amazing and fascinating. I almost wanted to explore more about his walkabout there, but I was afraid it would take over the whole show. That was really amazing stuff. And I meant what I said. If it wasn't for Peter at hello? What is that, all that clicking? If it wasn't for Peter at that first X conference, you know, I might have come home and been like, hey, forget all this shit. These people are crazy. But he was super friendly and just super welcoming to this whole scene. And I never forgot it because I came home and I was like, there's something to this. These people are pretty cool, you know. I was treated pretty cool by these folks. So big thanks to Peter Robbins for everything over the years and for coming on the show tonight. Next week, it's a little weird right now. I have a guest for you planned. I think it's going to be on Thursday night. It's going to be Colonel John Alexander, who has never been on the show before, but he's been in the field for a super long time, and he's really kind of a legend in all this. So, and I was afforded the opportunity to talk to him on the program here through my friend Patrick Weege, and I was like, yeah, I'll definitely talk to Colonel John Alexander. So that's sort of a surprise. I don't even know what to say. It's going to be a surprise episode in a sense, and we're going to be doing that on Thursday evening. So it's a special guest. Like I said, surprise show.
special guest, special night, Thursday night. I got to look on the calendar here. I don't even have the actual date in front of me. That's why I was kind of hesitant to even mention it too much. Let me see, paint. All right, open this thing up. March 8th. All right, so Thursday, March 8th, we're going to have Colonel John Alexander talking about his new book, relatively new. It came out in September. That's how long it takes me to put these shows together, folks. Reality Denied, firsthand experiences with things you can't – firsthand experiences with things that can't happen but did. That came out in September. It's from Anomalous Books. And that'll be next Thursday night, special guest, special night. I'm tempted to try to do a show also on Tuesday night because we're really close now to the end, folks. I'm gonna give you some real inside dirt here because I finally, after a lot of meandering, I think in January and like the beginning of this month, I finally pulled the trigger on the season finale guest who I want to have on the show for the season finale. And I reached out this weekend and I heard back from him and it's a go. So we have the finale guest and I'm pretty sure we have the finale date and I'm waiting to solidify it all this week, but essentially later this week, at some point this week. So essentially, we're really at the end. It's not Colonel John Alexander, so don't worry. That's not the finale. But I'd say we're like maybe 4, 5, 6 weeks away at this point. So we're really close, and it's bittersweet. Let me put it that way. It's bittersweet, and I knew I really sort of like had grappled with this over the weekend. And I was like, all right, it's time. It's time to pull the trigger on this. Let's book the finale guest. And it looks like it's a go. So don't be sad. Don't be sad. I'll have info on that eventually. Once it's locked in. Once it's locked in, I'll probably announce the finale date, let's say, as soon as I can. And I'll announce the finale guest, like, right beforehand. Because I don't want some clown shoe to, like, come in and swoop in and be like, we're going to have the guest next week. So I'm going to try to avoid that. But for now, Colonel John Alexander, next week, talking about Reality Denied, March 8th. So, wait a minute. How was that? Yeah, I guess it is March 8th. Yeah, because the first, all right. I'm all confused. It's like 10 days from now. And if I had my druthers, I would do a show on Tuesday night. But I'm laughing because you all know that anytime I make a promise like that, I wind up breaking it. So if I say the show is going to be posted on Saturday, it's going to be posted on Sunday. Or if I say we're going to be back on this date, you can usually count on us being back like 2 weeks later. So if I said we were going to do a show next Tuesday night in addition to the show next Thursday night, there's almost no chance that will happen. So I'm going to hold back on that. And hopefully, maybe, possibly do a show, because I think it would be fun, but I think I would probably deeply regret it the subsequent weekend now when I have two shows to put out. But nonetheless, thanks for listening tonight. It was a really awesome experience here with Peter, and you'll be hearing from me at the very least next Thursday night, March 8th, with Colonel John Alexander, talking about his new book, Reality Denied, and exploring all kinds of cool stuff. So I'm sure it's going to be an amazing show because I've wanted to talk to him for quite a while, actually. He's sort of one of those people that was like always on the list for guests, but I never got around to getting them on the show, and, you know, regular guests became sort of like family members, and we'd have them on the show all the time. The number of new spaces would be limited every season, and so it was like it was harder to get sort of it was harder to fit in new people. But at this point, we're right at the end here, and he's somebody I always want to talk to, so it'll be really cool to get him on the show. And I guess that's it for tonight. So thank you, everybody, for listening. Thanks again to Peter Robbins. And until next time, this is your friend, Tim and all, signing off.